Hello, I'm delighted to say that this episode of Film Stories is sponsored by NordVPN. Now, if you're unfamiliar with a VPN, it is a virtual private network, and it's a service that basically allows you to pretend that your computer or device is in a different country. So you set a virtual location for your device, and that means that suddenly you can get access to things that otherwise you might not be able to see. So for instance, if you're a Netflix subscriber, you set your NordVPN to America, then you get a plethora of options from American Netflix rather than UK Netflix, which is where this podcast is based. You can do this with all sorts of things. You switch the virtual location of your VPN service, and then you get access to TV shows, to films, to sporting events, streaming services and such like that you just wouldn't be able to get from the UK. A quick mention too for the cybersecurity features of NordVPN, including shielding your online activities, encrypting your connection, and using threat protection as well. To take advantage of this, you need to go to nordvpn.com/filmstories. That's nordvpn.com/filmstories. And you can try it risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan. If you go to that Film Stories link, that will give you an extra 4 months free on top of the 2-year plan. And again, there's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. And you will also find the link in the podcast episode description box. Hello, this is Simon Brew. I'm the editor of Film Stories magazine, and a very warm welcome to the Film Stories podcast. I'm delighted for this intro to invite Peter Capaldi along just to share his views on how I am at hosting a podcast.
I mean, you are a real boring.
Come with me.
And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
In movies that had stories.
That the story just sucks them in.
This is just the beginning.
Stories. We would be honored if you would join us.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to Film Stories with Simon Brew. I am Simon Brew. As always, there's absolutely everything you need to know about me. In the podcast, though, well, it's given away by the title. I'm here to talk of the stories of films, and I tend to talk about development stories, production stories, marketing stories, release stories, all the ingredients, really, that go towards making the films that we know and sometimes love. Just that, the films that we know and sometimes love. The films I tend to cover on this podcast, they lean more towards the mainstream than anything else. They're films I'm interested in or invested in to some degree. I try not to do snark. I try not to punch down. This podcast is a celebration of cinema and a real appreciation, really, that somehow, for all the difficulties, movies get made. And for this particular episode, the first of the two films I'm going to talk about, heck, is there a story? Let me take you back into the world of Walt Disney Animation. Let me take you back to the 1980s. I'm going to set this story up with a clip from the trailer for the film, and then we'll come to it the other side of this.
Legend has it there was once a king so cruel and so evil that the gods feared him. Since no prison could hold him, he was trapped forever in the form of a great black cauldron.
The Horned King, that black-hearted devil.
Walt Disney Pictures presents The Black Cauldron. Escape into a world of darkness.
Are you coming?
Me? Go in there? Oh, no. It's a terrible place.
A world of excitement. A world of dreams.
Aaron, the greatest warrior, a true hero.
And through the magic of 70mm photography and 6-track Dolby sound, you will be transported to a fantasy event for the entire family.
Now, I just ran that clip long enough to get the key words in there that Disney sold this film in the trailer as a family event for all the family. A family event. If you've seen The Black Cauldron, my life, within about 5 minutes, it's very clear the last thing it is a family event. The film's eventual credited directors, Ted Berman and Richard Rich. The film is The Black Cauldron, dating back to 1985. What, quite a lot of credits on it. I mean, the story in the end was credited to Ted Berman, Vance Gerry, Joe Hale, David Jonas, Roy Morita, Richard Rich, Art Stevens, Al Wilson, Peter Young. The source is Lloyd Alexander's books, which I'll come to shortly. A voice cast who I don't really touch on in the bit we're going to talk about, but it's Grant Bardsley, Susan Sheridan, Freddie Jones, Nigel Hawthorne in there, Arthur Millay, John Byner, Phil Fondacaro, and John Hurt. God bless John Hurt. So, in the aftermath of the death of Walt Disney towards the end of the 1960s, Walt Disney Animation needed really to find itself a fresh footing. It had built up off a bunch of animators who'd stayed with the company for a very long time. And the stories really you sort of knew roughly what you were going to get. It was in 1971 that Disney turned its attention to Lloyd Alexander's stories, The Chronicles of Prydain. Now, this is five books that had Welsh mythology at their foundations, really. And so Disney took an option on them, with the plan being to take the first of those two, the first two of those books, that would be The Book of Three and The Black Cauldron, and use that as the basis for an animated feature film. So the deal was complete in 1973 and development work got underway at that point. It had some of the legendary gang of Walt Disney's Nine Old Men working on the film. The Nine Old Men were anointed in the 1950s really by Disney himself as basically the rock, the cornerstone of Disney's animation work. They were the key animators that Disney himself had identified. And two of that legendary gang were involved in choosing this particular project. They would be Ollie Johnson and Frank Thomas. The subject themselves are a really interesting documentary called Frank and Ollie, which I think is still just about on Disney Plus. But still, there was a denseness, a richness to Lloyd Alexander's stories that made them incredibly hard to adapt. They were effectively trying to boil to, well, there's no effectively, they were trying to boil two of five books down to what, a 90-minute feature film, one that all the family could enjoy. It had a very large cast list. I mean, straight away, that was impractical for any kind of movie, really. It had to be manageable. You had to be able to get a handle on it all. And so the development work got underway and there was lots of work on which direction to take the story. There was lots of early work done as well on the sheer look of the film. But several years went by, and then it was in August 1978 that the New York Times ran an article about the film that would become The Black Cauldron. Now, at that point, it was pegged as a film that was going to cost $15 million. $15 million in 1978 was a very, very high movie budget. This was not Disney skimping on it. This was, in fact, originally earmarked as the studio's big release for 1980. However, that summer 1978 New York Times report, well, really, it put across the fact that this film was in trouble, that it was already 4 years behind schedule. Now, if you consider at the moment that a high-end Disney animated film tends to take 4 years start to finish, the fact that The Black Cauldron was 4 years late, it wasn't even taking 4 years to complete, it was 4 years late, was quite something. Now, the problem was an animator shortage. There were several problems, but that was at the heart of it. And the studio boss at the time was a man called Ron Miller. He had been handpicked by Walt Disney to be his successor. And Miller was overseeing really a generational shift that was taking place at Disney, that it had this crop of animators who had come up with the company and enjoyed the success and helped build the success of the company and its animated films. And on the flip side of that, there were new recruits coming in, and really those new recruits needed a level of expertise that they didn't have at the start of the Black Cauldron project. And so there was a point where Disney decided to switch the emphasis of its efforts to another film it had going, which was The Fox and the Hound, which was earmarked for 1980, but actually that would end up late too, which I'm coming to shortly. So It was at the end of the 1970s where things really went wrong here, that Disney had been enjoying the fruits of re-releasing its animated films. They were helping put some money in the coffers. And there were projects on the go that would help bring, really build up the experience level of the incoming animators. That heading up the animation team at that point was a man called Don Bluth. He was said to be working on a 25-minute short film to help these new animators cut their teeth on something substantive. Short films at this point were making Disney no money, but in terms of giving animators a chance to just get their hands dirty, were very, very useful vehicles. And then, of course, there was The Fox and the Hound, which was a much more straightforward and very traditional style of Disney film, although that in itself caused lots of upset. That's a whole story for another time. But it was animals in a wood, and you know, this was kind of the stuff that Disney was a lot more familiar with. But Don Bluth would really be the catalyst for some significant change that went on at Disney, because by 1979, he was just desperately unhappy. He had been identified as the cream of the next generation of animation talent at the studio. And he got to the point where in his late 30s, he was heading up its animation unit. But in 1979, frustrated at how slowly the Black Cauldron project was moving, as well as lots of other issues at the studio, he left. Now, Don Hahn is a producer of Disney films such as Beauty and the Beast and The Lion King, but also an excellent documentarian. He's been a guest on this podcast before, talking about his film Howard, about the life and times of the late Howard Ashman. But for the purposes of this particular story, it's his documentary feature, Waking Sleeping Beauty, that I really just cannot recommend enough. This is Don Hahn telling the story from an insider's perspective of how Walt Disney feature animation basically got to the edge of the cliff, nearly just out of business altogether, and pulled itself back. And the Black Cauldron was what was pushing it towards that cliff edge. Han charts this superbly in his film. And he also talks about the impact that Don Bluth's departure really from Disney had, because it wasn't just Bluth that went. He took 14, well, I've seen different sources, I've seen 13 people or 14 people. What they tend to agree on, though, is it was basically half of the animation payroll went with him. As per a Los Angeles Times report on September the 13th, 1979, that was the day that Don Bluth just dropped his bombshell, and he and his team of animators went off to set up another company, starting their work in Don Bluth's garage. At the point this happened, I mean, it opened up some gaps for other animating talent to come through. This is how people like John Lasseter and Tim Burton got their break in Disney. But still, as Don Bluth would later on explain to the Los Angeles Times, we were just a group who loved animation and felt it had disintegrated into something quite inane. He said Walt wasn't there and the pictures were just repeats of things he'd done. I mean, films like Fox and the Hound were not inspiring people. He said we wanted things to work there, but it's hard to reshape an old company. It's like trying to bend an old oak. So Bluth quickly away from Disney was pushing an animated feature called The Secret of Nim, which came together a lot quicker than The Black Cauldron did. But also, this was really the impetus Disney needed to get its own foot on the accelerator. However, it had to fill in the gaps it had internally. It had to replenish its ranks of animators, and they had to be brought into the Disney fold and the way of doing things. And so the immediate knock-on of that was The Fox and the Hound was delayed a year. And again, The Fox and the Hound, far more straightforward project, really, but that went from 1980 to 1981. 1980, it was roughly the point where The Black Cauldron formally got its green light as well, where Disney just got off the fence and just said, yeah, Ron Miller, just, we're going to do this. We're going to press forward with it. It had had 6 odd years of development to that point, and as per the earlier New York Times report, it was already 4 years behind schedule. It was about to get even more behind schedule, and the price was starting to go up as well. Just because it had the green light, it didn't mean the problems were going away. In fact, it meant there were more just coming down the track at speed. But at the heart of the decision to make The Black Cauldron in the first place was Disney really taking a leap. And I think this is often forgotten, really, that it was taking a gamble, that it could, as Don Bluth had noted, make repeats of the same pictures and then re-release its old movies. That wouldn't be a problem, that it could keep making money that way. But what Disney features were not attracting were teenagers. Teenagers are a very lucrative part of the market, that you could put out an animation like The Fox and the Hound and you get under 10s and their parents in. But if you really wanted to make a bigger hit, you've got to broaden the audience for the films. In fact, Walt Disney, as a broader studio, would struggle with this right throughout the 80s and 90s, attracting a teenage audience. And it wouldn't really crack it until the early 2000s, when it bought up Marvel, when it bought up Lucasfilm as well. And then all of a sudden it had the feature films that teenagers were desperate to see. But the late 1970s, the early 1980s, Disney was a company really making kids films, kids and family films. That was what it was known as. The project, the Black Cauldron project, was not short of ambition. It wasn't just that they picked material that they felt could transcend their usual audience. Disney had also decided to really go for it, that it was trying to set a high watermark for its animation, not least because it had a new competitor snapping at its heels. And so it was going to be filmed in 70mm. This is a big dramatic gesture. The first time a Disney animated film had been in 70mm since Sleeping Beauty. And as you heard in the clip right at the start there, to be released with 6-track sound, which is commonplace now, but that was a ramp up at that point. And of course, it's animation. You have to create all of those sounds from scratch. You can't take a microphone out and just accompany it with live action footage. Everything had to be made. It was setting itself one hell of a job. If we pinpoint that production started in 1980, which is generally the consensus on the Black Cauldron, although it's one of those where lots of people have different stories. The story I'm zeroing in on is by an animator called Michael Perazza. Now, in the early 2010s, Perazza was putting together a terrific blog which has been archived online. And he wrote about his experience as one of the animators working on the Black Cauldron, and in particular, the cultural problems behind the scenes of the movie. Because in an article that he entitled Cauldron of Chaos, what Perazza had noted was that the schism that existed in the animation building. He wrote, in this corner, there were the veterans, including what was left of Walt's 9 old men. He said they were almost all gone by then, although thankfully some would still come by and check in with us from time to time. But he said in another corner, there was a generation of great artists that hadn't really had their opportunity to strut their stuff with the old guard in place and were hoping to get their chance. Now, the Black Cauldron would give some of them a chance. The directors were ultimately Art Stevens, Ted Berman and Rick Rich were chosen to take that job on. Although by the end of the production, Art Stevens would not be one of the credited directors. But also, interestingly, one of the original directors of the Black Cauldron was set to be a man called John Musker. Now, Musker was a very upcoming animator through the Disney ranks, and he had been mentored to a degree by the 9 Old Men as well. And this was to be his directorial debut. But his tone for where he wanted to take the Black Cauldron was determined to be too light. And so Disney appointed a producer by the name of Joe Hale, and he was the person who was going to have to get this film ultimately from A to B. He came on board in 1980, and under his watch, things got even darker. And that meant there was no place for John Musker or the person who would go on to be his directorial partner across his career, Ron Clements. Now, they went off to do a picture called The Great Mouse Detective, as we know it here in the UK. Basil the Great Mouse Detective, a film I'm really, really, really fond of. But it's interesting that the people who were shuttled away off the project were the ones who would be absolutely fundamental in Disney's ultimate resurgence in animation. They would direct, Musker and Clements would direct The Little Mermaid, they would direct Aladdin. In more recent times, they directed Moana and gave the studio some of its biggest hits, but they weren't determined to be right for The Black Cauldron. Production then was ongoing without them, really. And let's go back to Perazza's article. He just talked about how the layout department was given gorgeous new 70mm widescreen charts from our scene planning department to compose their scenes. But Perazza said, after using them for a few weeks, I found myself comparing them to an old set Don Griffith of Disney had given to me from working on Sleeping Beauty. And Perazza noticed a marked difference in the width versus height ratio. As he wrote, unfortunately, by the time I discovered the discrepancy and went to Dave Thompson in the scene planning to show him, quite a few scenes had already been handed out to the animators and thus had to be adjusted as we were given the new, improved and corrected field charts. It wasn't quite a case that the work had to be completely redone, but time had to be taken to go and make the corrections, an avoidable error, really. Outside of specifically the production of The Black Cauldron, there were broader issues, really, with regards cartoonists working in and around Hollywood. And that led to a further challenge for the production, because for 10 weeks in 1982, as the film was supposed to be moving forward, animators across Hollywood went on strike. This basically brought The Black Cauldron to an absolute standstill. And so for nearly 3 months, really, the project lay pretty much dormant. And then as it continued to go through development, I mean, it did finally move forward with the idea of get the film out by 1984, which was finally looking doable. There was another big upheaval behind the scenes, because as much as The Black Cauldron was challenging just the sheer ambition of what Disney had done on screen before, the techniques that were being used to animate it were really ramping up. There was so much in the craft of the film and the way it was being put together that was trying to evolve Disney. The biggest evolution in the studio in the midst of all of this was in the boardroom, that Ron Miller, again, the man who'd been handpicked by Walt Disney to head up the studio, was ultimately defenestrated as Disney's chairman. The people brought in to take over, well, they came across from Paramount Pictures, where they'd been enjoying an enormous amount of success, and Disney wanted that success. So installed as Disney's new chairman of the overall company was a man called Michael Eisner, who would stay with Disney for a couple of decades. Books have been written about Michael Eisner's time at the top of Disney, not least by Eisner himself. And he brought with him then his colleagues. Eventually they would part company with some animosity. But at this point, he brought with him a man called Jeffrey Katzenberg as studio chairman. Now, in the mid-1990s, Katzenberg and Eisner would have a very obvious falling out, and Katzenberg would go and co-found the DreamWorks Animation Studio. But at this point, they were working together. Katzenberg heading up the studio, Eisner heading up the overall company. And the first signs were not good for the animation division when the pair came in, that there were reportedly conversations about shutting down Walt Disney Animation altogether. And I mean, it was Don Hahn in the midst of all of this who was one of the people trying to hold it together as a production manager on The Black Cauldron, even as things in the boardroom were changing. And he talked to Collider about this. He just described how I was the guy who walked around with a clipboard and asked what scenes they would have done that week. And he described this bizarre situation where there were three directors, and the three directors didn't always talk, and that instead they would go to Joe Hale, who would have to mediate between them all. But the three directors were splitting up sequences, and as Han said, with each sequence having completely a different tone and tempo, that nothing was really matching here. The animation wasn't matching, the atmosphere wasn't matching, and Han, not with no understatement, described it as another part of the problem. There was also that schism again between the old guard animators and the incoming young animators, to the point where the old guard and the new guard, if you like, were on separate floors at the studio, and they weren't even getting in the same room to talk. So in comes Eisner and Katzenberg. Now, ahead of this, Roy Disney, who was by now heading up animation, he'd seen an early cut of the film and he was not happy. He was said to be incredibly disturbed by the violence in The Black Cauldron, by the graphic opening of the film as well. And so it hadn't gone down with him. By the time it had screened for Eisner and Katzenberg, heck, it hadn't gone down well with them either. Katzenberg was said to have absolutely hated the initial rough cut of the film that he saw, which was running to about 92 minutes, and he wanted big changes to it. This was in 1984. This was months ahead of the release of the film, and Katzenberg at this point was an absolute novice to animation. And so a lot of this is charted in James Stewart's book, Disney War, which I've used a few times on this podcast. But Katzenberg, again, not understanding the process, just turned to Joe Hale and said, well, you've got to edit it. You've got to change it. You've got to you've got to take stuff out of this. You've got to rework it. And Hale had to explain. It's just like, no, everything you see is handcrafted. You can't use a different take of a shot, because that was the take that was drawn. That was it. That is all you can do. Katzenberg told Joe Hale, you've got to edit the film. You've got to take 10 minutes out of it. Hale stood his ground and said no. Katzenberg went into the edit suite himself to start the work. And so at this point, Joe Hale was not a happy person, as you would expect. He put in a call to Roy Disney. Roy Disney at that point was having lunch with Michael Eisner. And again, as James Stewart notes in his book, he's butchering the Black Cauldron, Hale fumed about Katzenberg. Now, it was admitted that The Black Cauldron was a dark film, but again, the whole idea, Disney knew that going in. That bit wasn't a surprise, although the new management, it was a surprise to them. But the idea was they're trying to be more contemporary. They're trying to be edgier. The animators, when they learned that Jeffrey Katzenberg was in the edit room hacking away at their work, they were in absolute uproar. And so in the end, Michael Eisner fairly quickly had to intervene, and he had to get Jeffrey Katzenberg out of the editing room. As he said, what are you doing? He said to Katzenberg, everybody's upset. And in the end, Eisner did calm Katzenberg down. And he left the editing room, but he told the team in no uncertain terms, you've got to fix the movie. Now, this did not cultivate a friendship between Roy Disney and Jeffrey Katzenberg at that point. That was a difficult relationship as well. But the cutting of The Black Cauldron was underway again. That Katzenberg was the boss of the animation division. If he ultimately wanted it cut down, it had to be cut down. And after a decade of work to get to this point, the final cut of The Black Cauldron was really been hacked together at the last minute, and not to the film's benefit. I mean, if you've ever watched the final cut of the film, A, you've got nightmares and you need a good therapist. But B, I mean, the continuity of it, the sense of it isn't quite there. There is a sense that things are missing. Still, Disney delayed the film to try and accommodate some of the changes. It moved it from Christmas 1984 to summer of 1985. And in the end, the film was trimmed by about 10 to 12 minutes. One of the casualties of this was Elmer Bernstein's score for the film. It was quite a leap for Disney to be releasing an animated film with no songs in it. And so Elmer, particularly in the 80s, I mean, particularly at this point in its history. And so Elmer Bernstein's score was going to have to carry some of the load, but most of that was gone. And of course, the studio around The Black Cauldron was not standing still. There were other films that were being developed. In fact, Joe Hale and many of the Black Cauldron team were expected to move on to an animated feature called Mistress Masham's Repose, which was in development as well. And of course, the Great Mouse Detective project was also moving. But now it was all about the build-up to the release of The Black Cauldron, July the 24th, 1985. And with a price tag, this didn't come out for many, many years. In fact, it was Don Hahn who revealed it. A price tag that had ballooned to $44 million in 1980s money. $44 million. An incredible amount of money to spend on any film. And Disney was, it was all in. So much so, in fact, that when the Motion Picture Association of America came back with a PG rating, I still think Disney got off light there, it went with it. This was the first Disney animated movie to carry a PG. I remember when Pixar, I think it was The Incredibles, was the first Pixar film to get a PG, and such a big deal was made of that. Here in the 1980s, pathfinding was underway. It just wouldn't go anywhere near as well. The Black Cauldron arrived, 5 years late, really, twice as expensive, and in the end nearly took Disney Animation down. The reviews of the film actually were really, really strong. On a technical level, the 75mm, the six-channel sound, that was singled out for praise. But also, the fact that it was such a swing was and so different from what people were expecting from Disney. In many critical circles, it earned it very, very strong to good write-ups. Even Lloyd Alexander would, I mean, he would say that the film doesn't really sit alongside the book particularly, but he enjoyed the film. It's not an adaptation of his stories that he considered really, but the film he was quite happy with. There were naysayers, really, that who weren't so keen on it. However, off it went into cinemas on that weekend, July the 26th to the 28th, and there was competition out there. I mean, the films that were out were Kiss of the Spider-Woman, there was The Heavenly Kid was released, but National Lampoon's European Vacation was the number one movie that weekend. On its opening week, it opened with $12.3 million in the US. Films that were also in cinemas, I mean, Back to the Future was in second place on its fourth week of release, 9.4 million it took on its fourth week. E.T., a re-release of E.T. many years after the original, that was in third place, $5 million. You made more money re-releasing E.T. than spending $44 million on The Black Cauldron. It opened in fourth with $4.1 million. Now, no matter, you might think, and rightly so, because family movies tend to build audiences over a period of time, and the expectation was at the very least The Black Cauldron might do that. I mean, there was other family fare around at that point. The Goonies was towards the bottom of the chart, although Rambo First Blood Part 2 wasn't attracting quite as many families. The problem with The Black Cauldron was the word of mouth was not helping it. And so the following week, films such as Fright Night and Weird Science came out. Black Cauldron dropped to fifth as Back to the Future went up to first place. That was on week five of release, and it was comfortably outgrossing Disney's movie. The Black Cauldron disastrously dropped out of the top 10 altogether after 3 weeks. Other films that were knocking it down, Real Genius, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, Summer Rental came out. By the end of the summer, it was clear that this was not going to be salvaged. Week four, it was down to 16th place, almost unthinkable for a Disney animation. Teen Wolf then comes along the following week. That makes a fair amount of money. A re-release of Ghostbusters makes a fair amount of money. But by the time The Black Cauldron limped out of US cinemas, its box office was way below what Disney needed to be. What, $20, $21 million? It was, there was no way of rewriting this. It was a massive disappointment. And it was leaving a real hole in Disney's bottom line as well. Was animation really worth still investing in if this was, you know, if this was the kind of return that the studio could expect? Has it lost its magic touch? It's telling as well. The legacy of the film is a very bumpy one. I mean, how long did it take for us to get a proper DVD release of it? Ages. And even now, we don't have a Blu-ray of it. We don't have a 4K disc of it. You go round a Disney theme park, if you find any mention of The Black Cauldron in anything other than a slight Easter egg, you are doing incredibly well. When they run those floats down the Disney theme parks with all the characters, there is not a single character from The Black Cauldron on them, I can tell you that. There was also the end credits of Disney's 2023 100th anniversary animation feature, Wish. And across the end credits of that, there are visual nods to virtually every Disney animated film to that point. One of those that's missing, that would be The Black Cauldron. And it's not a film that Disney has deleted entirely. It's certainly done its fair share of those, but it's just hidden at the back. It's not something Disney wants to talk about. And if you sit and watch it, and even now, and sit, I mean, it's chilling and fast. The 80s was not shy of very, very creepy family films. This was full on, I would suggest. But in the end, Disney decided to stick with animation, and The Black Cauldron would hasten the reset at Disney Animation as well. Joe Hale would leave fairly soon after this, as would several who'd worked on the film. Mistress Masham's Repose, that would be quickly cancelled. But it was films such as The Great Mouse Detective and Oliver and Company that kind of reset the tone and started to rebuild an audience for the studio. But in the end, it was those two animators taken off The Black Cauldron who would be at the heart of what became, just 5 years later, really, Disney's second golden age of animation. Ron Clements and John Musker, along with Howard Ashman, producer and composer, again, the subject of that excellent Howard documentary. Well, they were the ones, they were crucial to fashioning what became The Little Mermaid. And in the aftermath of The Little Mermaid, that, I mean, it just revolutionised what Disney animation was standing for again. I mean, standing too, looking back at their success, Clements and Musker would recall how they were, quote, basically banished from the Black Cauldron. Going back to that Michael Piazza thing as well, I mean, just to tie up Jeffrey Katzenberg's, he did say that Piazza did write that Jeffrey wasn't really an animation person. However, he proved to be a very hardworking exec and showed how serious he was in rectifying his lack of knowledge by immediately going into a thorough self-education process involving every step of the creative and production processes used in Disney feature animation. He soon became a hands-on manager who garnered the respect of quite a few on the staff, including me, and along with Roy Disney's help and guidance, would see Disney's animation eventually regain its prominence in the field. It would not take that long to do, ironically enough. Hale went, several others, that new guard of animators got their chance. And in Beauty and the Beast, actually, the 1991 film, what you see there is a fascinating marriage of that old guard versus new guard, but actually working more together. Meanwhile, as the tone of Disney films going forward was set, there has been a kind of fonder look back at the Black Cauldron, that an appreciation that it was taking bold swings a lot earlier than anyone else was in the family movie space. And perhaps in terms of its rehabilitation in Disney history, at least, it was quite telling that in 2020, Disney went back to this world and acquired the rights to the entire Chronicles of Prydain series of books with a view to a live-action franchise of movies. No progress on them there, but with the original Black Cauldron animation still out there, still ahead of its time, but still very much overlooked, it might be really quite fitting that this dark chapter in Disney's history comes a bit full circle and gets really the appreciation it deserves. Just do not show it to your kids unattended. And that brings me to the halfway point of this latest episode of Film Stories. As always, thank you for listening and thank you so much for your time. Just going to do a couple of parish notices before I get on to the second film, which is very sweary, but I've edited the swear words out. Firstly, if you like this podcast, there are three ways you can support it above listening to it. Thank you so much for listening to it. If you want to put some money in the pot and help financially support what we're trying to do with Film Stories, if you go to patreon.com/SimonBrew, anyone who supports us there gets the podcast early, they get it ad-free, they find out what we're up to behind the scenes as well. And also, you just help us do more of this. In terms of getting podcasts visible to people, the things that really help are subscribing at your podcast home of choice. That costs you absolutely nothing. Hugely appreciated. And also, if you can leave, ideally, a hugely positive review, particularly now when it's getting harder and harder to get noticed. Everyone who's done all of these things, thank you. I can't thank you enough for all of this. In terms of other parish notices, I'm just finishing off Film Junior, the new issue of the only regular film print magazine for youngsters. You can find that soon at store.filmstories.co.uk. I'll be telling you about the new issue of Film Stories magazine, another 168-page issue coming your way in February. And you can find out more about that soon at store.filmstories.co.uk as well. But that is enough of my parish notices. I'm already overrunning. So I want to move on to a British film that I absolutely adore. Absolutely adore this film. Going to play you a clip from the movie first, again with no swear words. And I'll come to the story the other side of this.
He did not say unforeseeable. You may have heard him say that, but he did not say that, and that is a fact.
I apologise for Malcolm.
Don't apologise for me. Apologise for yourself.
Is war unforeseeable, Minister?
To walk the road of peace, sometimes we need to be ready to climb the mountain of conflict.
Climb the mountain of conflict? You sound like Nazi Julie Andrews.
The PM wants you to go to Washington.
Talk to as few people as possible. That'd be best for you.
I'm gonna blow to Cade.
I feel like we should have hookers, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
You want girls?
No, absolutely not.
Who's Simon Foster?
He said war was unforeseeable, and I think he could be very useful on the war committee.
You're gonna use him as a little meat puppet.
You might be a scary little poodle back in London, but here you're nothing.
What is going on?
You're like the woman from The Omen. You've given birth to a demon, and now it's gonna kill you.
This will be the vote to commence military intervention.
That then is a clip from 2009's comedy In the Loop, directed by Armando Iannucci. Screenplay credited to Jesse Armstrong, Simon Blackwell, Armando Iannucci and Tony Roach, and based on the TV series The Thick of It. A cast here led by Peter Capaldi as the potty mouth Malcolm Tucker, alongside Tom Hollander, Gina McKee in there, Chris Addison, James Gandolfini, Anna Klumsky and Zach Woods, amongst a very extensive ensemble. Now, my confession here is before I saw In the Loop when it came out in 2009, I hadn't actually seen the TV series that it was based on, The Thick of It. The Thick of It is a terrific satirical television show, comedy half-hour episodes on the whole, that introduced the character of Malcolm Tucker, the foul-mouthed government advisor, spin doctor. And, I mean, I quickly remedied it afterwards, but I went in absolutely blasted away by some top-grade Fifth Dan swearing. Armando Iannucci had an extensive background in comedy to this point. I mean, you go to the very roots of Alan Partridge back on Radio 4, and there's Armando Iannucci's name in the thick of it, no pun intended. He hadn't actually directed a feature film by the time he came here. And so he kind of opted to make In the Loop his directorial debut. But as he admitted to Filmmaker magazine, that really wasn't always the plan, because he said, "I had absolutely no intention of doing a film of it. But he did say, I've always wanted to do a funny film." He said he wanted to do something fast and sparky, like a screwball comedy. And he says, "I've been attached to various projects, but I wanted to wait until I found the right story." And that's when I read more and more about the stupid sort of office politics that went on in the lead up to the Iraq War. Now, this was the second Iraq War that began in 2003. And when Iannucci discovered some of the things that led up to it, he did say that's the story. And so he kind of reconciled, again, as he told Filmmaker magazine, "I've got the model here of how The Thick of It works. So why don't we take that, but not have the same minister, government minister and staff, because this is international and The Thick of It's a more domestic story." He knew that the war story could bring together UK and US governments and explore the so-called special relationship between the pair. At the point this was being put together, I mean, Tony Blair and George W. Bush had really come together quite strongly in the build-up to and the aftermath of the Iraq War. And even though Blair was no longer the Prime Minister at the point In the Loop came out, his shadow really is partly over the movie. That Iannucci too knew that he would need a UK and a US cast, and it would also give him a chance to basically start over, with one exception, that he carried one character over from the TV show to the big screen, and that would be Malcolm Tucker, as played by Peter Capaldi. Now, the half-hour episode format that they'd been working to for several years of The Thick of It, that had clear boundaries for Iannucci. I mean, he's talked quite interestingly about how much you have to get through in the first 5 minutes of a half-hour TV episode, because you've just got to set so much up in such a short space of time. And that, so by this point in 2007, they'd done a couple of hour-long special episodes of The Thick of It, and so he'd seen the potential in expanding this over a longer running time. And so this was it. They kind of saw the potential of what was possible. Very early on, Iannucci set himself an upper limit of 105-minute running time. It couldn't go for longer than 1 hour 45. He, like many of us, was fed up sitting through comedies that went well past the 2 hour mark and really had run out of steam. But he brought together the key writing team that brought The Thick of It to life. That would be Jesse Armstrong, now known for Succession, Simon Blackwell and Tony Roach, as well as himself. And they knew between them the machinations of the UK government system quite well, but they threw themselves into researching how the George W. Bush administration in the US had been, including characters such as Dick Cheney and Condoleezza Rice. And again, as they told filmmakers, just as part of the research is to get the authenticity right, just in the detail. And what they uncovered here was that, quote, "a lot of of Washington is run by 23-year-olds. They do spend a lot of time hanging around more senior people's offices in the hope of being spotted, which means they do all their work at night. And then there's that thing about if you leave the meeting, you leave the power. So you must never leave the meeting. There were lots of little comedy beats that they were identifying in the midst of this. They were throwing out stories that they considered too silly, but then some of the stuff they considered too silly, they then discovered further down the track that that's the stuff that would actually happen. Now, Jesse Armstrong would go a bit more into the process in an interview with Clash, and he just said it's exactly the same format as used in The Thick of It, that Armando holds it together in the middle. Simon Blackwell, Tony Roach and I meet him, then come up with the storyline. Us three go away and do the storyline, then send it to Armando to be okayed and do the initial drafts. Then Ian Martin does additional material and rewrites it as well. And so it's basically a five-man team at the heart of The Thick of It. And then in terms of the writing of In the Loop, that was mirrored exactly there as well. A five-man team once again. Armstrong added that it's a five-man team that's broken down into, quote, different compartments. And so he said it never feels unwieldy. And then he explained the next part of the process. He said, once we had the storyline mapped out with Armando, each of us took an act each, if you think of it as a three-act movie. And so Armstrong took the first act, that it would be Simon Blackwell took the second, Tony Roach did the third. Then they brought them all together, looked at them all, they got their notes off Armando Iannucci, then they all did a rewrite, and then they passed the acts around so that everybody could interrogate the other person's work. And again, Jesse Armstrong, he said, it's not like one person does the plot, one does the jokes, and one does the politics, but he did say we all have our different strengths. Now, what this meant was a very sizable script in the end. In fact, Peter Capaldi, in an interview with Under the Radar, said, I did a number of readings on a number of variations of the script. They did a trio of table reads in the end, and he said each time the script was about 400 pages long. So the old adage with movies is one page of script equals 1 minute of screen time. So by my bad maths, that's 6.5 hour film with a bit of change on top. Capaldi would say it was a really good script, and it wasn't necessarily the movie that we ended up with or the story that we ended up with. But he argued it was in there somewhere. And then eventually they settled on one story in amongst those 400 pages, and we began to pursue that. And this was leaning on a book by celebrated journalist Bob Woodward called Plan of Attack, leaning too on a research trip to Washington, and then the whole thing modelled, as Iannucci had hinted before, on a screwball comedy. This came together in the end then relatively quickly, that BBC Films was involved, the UK Film Council, before it was disbanded, was putting in some money. Optimum Releasing in the UK was going to put the film out. Optimum Releasing is no longer with us. I think the rights to this have now gone on to Studio Canal instead. But for the purposes of this, it was looking at a cinema release. In fact, that's clearly what they made it for, that Peter Capaldi came back in very early. Chris Addison, also one of the stars of The Thick of It, but in a different role, he was on board early as well. And then the cast was fleshed out. Steve Coogan would take a role. Tom Hollander was announced in May of 2008. James Gandolfini was also announced in May 2008, and quite a coup to get Tony Soprano in the movie. Now, Gandolfini hadn't worked with this team before either, and so his process was slightly different. He went off to the Pentagon for a couple of days. He also went apparently to get his hair cut alongside four-star generals and was just relaying back some of the stories. Armando Iannucci's directorial process, meanwhile, was not for rehearsals. That, as Peter Capaldi would say to Under the Radar, we did some workshops in New York with James Gandolfini and the rest of the American cast. So we sort of played the scenes, but not written. And as Capaldi would say, James is playing the general, you're playing Malcolm. Now you're going to argue about this, whatever this might be. And so it was workshopping material that way, rather than specifically rehearsing the film. This was more of a culture shock to the American actors. I mean, in particular, two who work quite closely together are Anna Chlumsky and Zach Woods. And Chlumsky has admitted that it took her a day to get into this, that this wasn't the way she'd done a film before. And then she sort of realised, well, what she has to do is top whatever Zach Woods was doing, and then it can start to work. The start of production was in May 2008, and as producer Kevin Loder said to Variety at the start of production announcement, "We hope that In the Loop will make you cry with laughter and possibly fear, as it takes you behind the scenes in the heart of the global political village." Iannucci, behind the camera, decided to shoot the film in a slightly different way to the way The Thick of It had been shot. Now, The Thick of It TV show had relied on a shaky cam documentary style, and Iannucci figured you can get away with that for half an hour on a smaller screen, but he had concerns about how that would look for 90 minutes on a cinema screen. And so he changed the technique a little bit. He didn't want it to go too glossy, but they used tools such as zoom and more traditional techniques really for the shooting of the movie. They kept the camera slightly steadier. Iannucci was insistent though that he still wanted the whole thing to feel a little bit messy and a little bit unfinished. He wanted to resist the urge to go too glossy. And if there's one word that came through in all the interviews that I've read that Iannucci did around the release of the film, it was fluidity. It was keeping the story, keeping the material fluid. Now, to make that happen, he kind of figured he needed to get instinctive, almost sometimes improvisational words out of his actors. And what he didn't want to do is the traditional film thing of someone does something brilliant just off the cuff, and then you have to set it all up again from a different angle with a different camera and shoot it twice, and you lose a little bit spark the second time. And so what he did was he shot the film with two cameras. And so always throughout, wherever the actors wanted to go, two cameras were on them. They would get slightly different direction off Iannucci, but fundamentally the actors got to a point where they knew that if they had a spark in their head or something, they could go with it and two cameras would capture it. They didn't have to worry about going back and doing it again. And so, I mean, as he explained, what we do have is these two cameras at all times because I want the actors to feel they can wander anywhere. He also said there are no marks on the floor, and he said that actually then dictates the style, and because we keep moving, it just allows you to cut in the edit. And the style of the film he was making meant you could do a fairly abrupt jump cut. That wasn't going to be a problem. They pretty much knew that. Even so, as much as there's a lot of improvisation and space for improvisation on the set, it was crucial that they shot the script first. And so the process throughout was you shoot the written word and make sure you've got that captured, and then you can take another look at it, and then you go back in and throw a few more things in, including just fresh bits and bobs, really, for the actors to react and respond against. And you just kind of see what you get. Now, for Iannucci, he did admit that the challenge with jumping to a feature for him was, quote, keeping the whole story in my head, keeping the rhythm, the pace at which the story was told as new elements and new characters were introduced into it. This was really his first directorial outing at such a length, really. And so that was the kind of thing he was trying to keep on top of. Amongst the locations of the film, I mean, the film primarily shot in the UK. It wasn't the longest of shoots, but there was a little bit of work done in Washington, but most of it is done in Britain. But a little bit of it as well is actually shot at 10 Downing Street. And they kind of figured they weren't going to get permission to do this, but they wrote a letter asking anyway. And because of timing and just because of the popularity of The Thick of It in the corridors of power, they just got a note back saying, yeah, all right. So the governing party in the UK at that point was the Labour Party. They were having their party conference in Blackpool at the point The Thick of It was shooting. And so they were able to go into Downing Street, and the people in the corridors of power were, it sounded like they were a little bit starstruck at seeing Malcolm Tucker, a character based loosely on government spin doctor Alistair Campbell at the time. Well, he was there in Downing Street, and it was kind of a little bit of a wow moment, really, that the cast and crew talked about how the people in Downing Street were taking pictures of Malcolm Tucker. Malcolm Tucker, more to the point, in Downing Street himself. If you aren't familiar with The Thick of It, if you're someone who's not in the UK, for instance, or you've never heard the show, it is really a behind the scenes working of government comedy, which is, I mean, it's quite something. It's uproariously funny, very, very foul mouth. And it was a bit of a surprise that it would get official permission that to film in the corridors of power. Peter Capaldi actually talked too about the process of making the film to the website Eye for Film, and he talked about how I think we were all learning about it as we went. I don't think any of us had done that sort of improvisation before, and after every take they were encouraged to respond to what they heard. And he said also sometimes it's far funnier on screen seeing someone just go what than seeing them come back with a really funny line. Still, by the time production wrapped up a few weeks after it began, Iannucci's two cameras had captured a fair amount of material that he could wade through in the edit to give himself a whole chunk of options. I mean, inevitably, there were some things and some rules that it was built around. I mean, Iannucci talked about how in the thick of it, they deliberately never show the Prime Minister, for instance. And so in the loop, they never wanted to show the President of the US. And he wanted to keep it real and believable and show the people doing the day to day stuff and make sure the focus is on there. And so, you know, when you do something like a motorcade, you have the day to day people in there who get excited about going in a motorcade. In fact, he did tell one story about when we were filming the motorcade in the film, and he said this to Eye for Film, we were using Dick Cheney's Outriders and we kept stopping at traffic lights then going again, and Iannucci was thinking, I have to get a shot where that didn't happen. And he described how the guy came over and just said, for one shot, do you want them to put their bells and sirens on so you could just go straight through the traffic lights? And that's what they did. And Iannucci was taken with moments like that, but he also said, I kept thinking, we mustn't get carried away because that's exactly what happened to the characters. The grounded realism and sticking to the rules of what he wanted this to be, whilst keeping that screwball comedy tone, was pivotal in the edit room, of course. And Iannucci had a lot of material to work with. But also he had that self-imposed rule, 1 hour, 45 minutes. And so his editing team was headed up by Billy Snedden and Ant Boyes. And Iannucci described the hardest part of the process. No, the worst part of the process was the word he used, was fine-tuning the film to get it down from a cut of 2 hours to 105 minutes. And in the end, that is exactly the running time that the film landed on. He was really, really, really disciplined on it and cutting and trimming and trimming. And the difficulty of it was right up there for him, really. The film was completed in time to go to the Sundance Film Festival in January of 2009. That's where it would make its debut, ahead of a cinema release in the UK in April 2009. The first critical response then came off the back of that Sundance screening, and it was primarily from people not familiar with the TV show. They were getting this pretty much absolutely cold, and the reviews were really strong. On the whole, really strong. Some people who were fans of The Thick of It felt it was just a little bit short of that, perhaps. I don't know. I mean, I couldn't comment on that because I wasn't a fan of The Thick of It at the time. I've rectified it since. But the In the Loop was knocking it out the park, really, for the people particularly who never met Malcolm Tucker before. Even those that had met him before, there's so much to love in the film. I mean, as long as your ears don't mind a bit of cussing, you're pretty much in gold here, I would suggest. So when it arrived in UK cinemas, the reviews were similarly strong. In fact, it got some absolute flat-out raves. It cost around £600,000 to make the film. And the release of it went well. I mean, it did okay in the UK. It also did okay in the US as well. I mean, it didn't get a huge release over there, but IFC Films put it out on limited release. And it picked up a couple of million in the US. By the time it had completed its theatrical run, it's hard to do my usual box office comparison on a film like this, it made what, $7-8 million worldwide. And so it had made profit and it had got strong reviews, and then just to ice the cake, in the midst of it all, it got an Oscar nomination as well, that at the Academy Award, the 82nd Academy Awards. And if you just want to, if you just want me to contextualize that, that was the one where The Hurt Locker won, where Avatar was knocking up tons and tons of nominations as well. There you had In the Loop screenplay in the best adapted screenplay category, ultimately won by Jeffrey Fletcher for Precious, based based on the novel Push by Sapphire, but going up against District 9 and Education and Up in the Air was in the loop. And I remember following Chris Addison's Twitter feed at the time at the kind of surreal moment where there he was on the screen at the Oscars when they played a little bit of a clip from the film. The character of Malcolm Tucker was revisited with further TV episodes of The Thick of It, but not kind of like the version and the world that we saw in The Loop. Instead, Armando Iannucci decided to go in slightly different directions when it came to his further film directing career. He would tackle the death of Stalin in 2017 and the personal history of David Copperfield in 2019. But as a calling card for people who didn't know his work, who were meeting him for the first time, In the Loop, number one, was just one hell of a film. It's still one hell of a comedy film. And also, I mean, beyond that, really, it led to his work, indirectly, it's up to you, really, his work in the US, not least the hugely successful political comedy series VP, which HBO picked up and ran from 2012. Still, if you've not had the pleasure, dig out In the Loop. It is available on streaming services. It is terrific. And, I mean, provided the people around you have the ears that can cope with it, you're going to be quoting it for an awful long time. Exactly your purview. And that brings me to the end of this latest episode of Film Stories. As always, thank you so much for listening and thank you for your time. If I've not bored you completely, you can find more from me on Twitter at Simon Brew. You can find more from the entire Film Stories project at Film Stories. We're on Facebook, facebook.com/filmstoriesonline. You can find us on YouTube, where we're putting some of these podcasts and some of our reviews as well, at youtube.com/filmstories. Our website is filmstories.co.uk, where you can find news, reviews, features across film, TV and gaming. And if you go to store.filmstories.co.uk, that's where you'll find all of our print magazines for sale that I told you about in the middle of this episode. But I think I've waffled on long enough. I've got a whole host of specials I'm putting together for you, which you'll find out about soon. Main thing, as always, you all take care. You all look after yourselves. I will be back soon with another bunch of film stories. Thank you so much for listening. Bye-bye.